Call to the lectern, Mr. Malcolm Honlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.
Thank you very much. That's okay. Betty is very well practiced, and before we start, I think it's really important for us to express our appreciation to Betty, to Adina, to Robert Singer, to the others at the World Jewish Congress, to Ellen Tal and Ron Prosor's associates, to the President's Conference, to all of those, the JJAC, the Justice for Jews from Arab Countries, all of whom helped make this meeting possible. So thank you all very much. You can applaud them. That's for you. Minister Shalom, Ambassador Prosor, Ambassador Lauder, Robert Sugarman, Chairman of the Conference, Sylvan Abitbol, and Rabbi Abadi, and many others who are here, all of our honored guests and speakers. We welcome you to this second event in the United Nations, aimed at helping to write the record of history and discuss the plight of the Jewish refugees from Arab countries. While it is often said that the lack of a solution to the Palestinian Arab-Israeli refugee issue is one of the major obstacles to Middle East peace, the truth is that an important element of the refugee problem has been ignored for these many years. Indeed, real progress towards a genuine and lasting peace in the Middle East entails recognizing both sides of the story, and that includes the persecution and expulsion of the Jews from Arab countries from the 1940s to the 1960s. More than half of Israel's Jewish population today consists of these Jews from Arab countries and their descendants. The experience of these Jewish communities, those who are expelled or forced to leave through persecution and violence, is an issue that we will explore this afternoon and that must become a priority on the international agenda. We will be privileged to hear the personal testimony from Jews from these communities, including that of our special guest, Minister Shalom. We will see a film clip of an important documentary that movingly depicts the experiences of these Jews who, as a result of numerous human rights violations, suffered the ethnic cleansing of ancient Jewish communities from these countries. And we will hear from an illustrious panel of authors and commentators about the travails experienced by their families. Since the founding of the Jewish state, the United Nations has done little, if anything, to address this issue. We are pleased today that we are in the company of many international leaders, ambassadors to the United Nations, leaders of the Jewish community and Jewish organizations, and many family members and descendants of the Jews from Arab countries whose story will be and must be told. Our first speaker, and we are really honored to have with us, is Minister Sylvan Shalom, a long friend of the American Jewish community, somebody who has always reached out to us and we to him. Minister Shalom is a member of the Israeli Knesset representing the Likud Yisrael Beiteinu and currently serves as Minister of National Infrastructure, Energy and Water and Minister of Cooperation. Previously, he served as Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Deputy Prime Minister, Vice Prime Minister, Minister of Finance, Minister of Science and Technology, and many other posts. Minister Shalom, when he speaks, always speaks with authority. But today, he also speaks from personal experience, as he was born in Tunisia. We are honored by his participation. Please welcome Minister Sylvan Shalom.
Thank you, Malcolm. I'm sorry that I'm with my back to you, but I'm very happy to be here today, ladies and gentlemen. It is really a great honor for me to address this audience on a matter that is so close to my heart, the history of the Jewish refugees from Arab countries and Iran. I want to thank my friend Ron Prosor, Ron Lauder, Bob Sugarman, and Stanley Ehrman, and of course, Malcolm Honlein. I would like also to thank Lucette, Lagnado, Linda Menuchin, Levana Zamir, and Tofi Kassab, who are sharing their stories with us today. Long before I was a minister in the Israeli government, my grandfather was a leader of the Jewish community in Gabes, Tunisia. It's a city in the southern part of Tunisia. One of the most important lessons he ever taught me was to pursue justice. Today we are going to pursue justice. I've come from the Jewish homeland with a request. Help me retrace the footsteps of the 1 million Jews who fled from the Arab countries and Iran. Help me tell their story. And help me deliver justice, because it is time that the world hears about the greatest untold story in the Middle East. Ladies and gentlemen, in 1945, 1 million Jews lived peacefully throughout the Middle East. It was a golden age of coexistence in which Jews' communities were woven into the fabric of the Arab countries. But this situation changed dramatically when the UN adopted partition plan in 1947. One day, after Israel declared its independence, the Arab world declared war on Israel. The 1948 War of Independence became not just a battle for Israel's survival, it was a battle to ensure a safe haven for all the Jews in the Arab world. The New York Times then published a front page story with the headline, and I would like to quote, "Jews in grave danger in all Muslim lands, 900,000 in Africa and Asia face wrath of their foes." Across the Middle East, Jews had their valuables seized and their homes looted. Synagogues were burned to the ground, anti-Semitic laws were passed, and violence broke out from Basra to Tripoli. Today, and to Cairo as well. Today, I think of the 2,000-year-old Jobar Synagogue near Damascus, built on the site where the prophet Elijah concealed himself and anointed his successor, Elisha, as a prophet. This synagogue, where the flames of Jewish life burned brightly for millennia, was burned to the ground earlier this year. Today, I think of the Jews of Basra, Iraq. For over 1,000 years, Jewish life was spirited and vibrant. Today, a dynamic community has become a desolate cemetery. All that remains are the tombstones of our great Talmudic sages who were laid to rest. Today, I think of the Jews of Yemen. They arrived in Saudi Arabia 2,500 years ago as merchants sent by the King Solomon to trade for the gold and silver that would decorate the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. For centuries, this community flourished. Today, they have almost vanished. Ladies and gentlemen, my family's story begins in the shadow of this suffering. My family was a part of the thriving community in Gabes, Tunisia, owning properties, businesses, and even a school. When Tunisia gained its independence in 1956, the new government passed a series of anti-Jewish laws. By 1958, Jewish courts were outlawed and Jewish community councils were abolished. Ancient synagogues and cemeteries were desecrated and the Jewish quarter of Tunis destroyed. My parents realized that there was no future for our family in Tunisia. We packed up what we were able to take with us and began the dangerous journey to Israel. Terrified of being caught, we told our neighbors that we were traveling to Paris for a long vacation. Some people dream of visiting the Eiffel Tower, but my family dreamed of moving to Israel and visiting the Tower of David. When we arrived in the Holy Land, we settled in a simple and a small apartment and started our new lives in Beersheba, the capital of the Negev Desert and the city of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Despite everything we had left behind and the struggles we faced as a new immigrants, we knew that we were home, safe from operation, persecution, and torment. Ladies and gentlemen, as all this occurred, the world stood silently and watched the persecution and discrimination. Today, much of the world remains silent on this issue. This injustice cannot continue. The truth cannot remain hidden. The stories of the Jewish refugees cannot be forgotten. The total area of land confiscated from Jews in Arab countries amounts to nearly 40,000 square miles. That is 5 times the size of Israel and 85 times the size of New York City. Israel's government and the World Jewish Congress are compiling a list of assets that were left behind by Jewish refugees as they fled the persecution. The Arab countries must accept responsibility for the billions of dollars of property they confiscated, for the holy sites that were looted and destroyed, and for the suffering of the 1 million Jews who had no choice but to flee for their lives. The United Nations must also accept its share of responsibility. In this institution, we hear a great deal about the suffering of the Palestinian refugees, but we never hear about the suffering of the 1 million Jewish refugees forced to flee from Arab countries and Iran. Over the last 65 years, the UN and its agencies have spent tens of billions of dollars on Palestinian refugees, but not a cent on the Jewish refugees. And since 1949, the United Nations has passed more than 100 resolutions on Palestinian refugees, and not a single one on Jewish refugees from Arab country. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to conclude with a story. In 2005, I was Israel's foreign minister, deputy prime minister, and I traveled to Tunisia on an official state visit. The first ever state visit of an Israeli minister to Tunisia. Unfortunately, the last one. I stepped up the plane with a delegation of Israeli-Tunisian Jews, including my mother. As a child, my mother had often described the beauty of the beach of Gabes in Tunisia. But when we visited together, I was surprised that it wasn't nearly as pretty as I had imagined. Seeing my reaction, my mother said something I will never forget. She said, and I would like to quote, 50 years ago, when we arrived in Israel, Beersheba, our hometown in Israel, was a tiny and barren desert town, while Gabes was a beautiful city on the seashore. Beersheba developed tremendously over the past 50 years and has become a metropolitan center for education and science. In contrast, Gabes is trapped in the past. It looked 50 years ago. End of quote. I quote it because it shows really what we would like to give you. My mother's words capture the spirit of Israel and the Jewish people, exiled, tormented, and persecuted like no other people. The Jews survived because we have always managed to rebuild, endure, and overcome every obstacle. Jewish tradition teaches us, in Hebrew it says, Da me'ain bata u'la'an ata olech. It means, know where you come from, and know as well where you are going to. We understand that to build a better future, we must learn the lessons of the past. I spoke to my mother earlier today, and she is proud that I'm here in the United Nations telling the story of our family. But it's just one of the million stories that need to be told. For too long, the stories of the Jewish refugees from Arab lands and Iran were untold. Their suffering and their rights ignored. Today is about bringing Jewish history to life and the stories of the Jewish refugees to light. I hope my words will open the eyes, ears, and hearts of the international community so that Jewish refugees will finally receive the justice they deserve. Thank you very much.
Is Ambassador Ron Prosor, no stranger to these halls. Ambassador Prosor has been serving as Israel's permanent representative to the United Nations since 2011. Previously, he served as Israel's ambassador to the United Kingdom, and before that as Director General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, capping a distinguished career in the service of the State of Israel. He is a vocal and eloquent spokesman for the State of Israel in the United Nations. He has never shied away from speaking truth and speaking truth to power. He has earned the respect of his colleagues, and I would say peers, but he doesn't have any. Please welcome Ambassador Ron Prosor.
Thank you, Malcolm. Malcolm Online, you're always on the front line and showing justice for Jews everywhere in the world. And thank you from all of us. Before I begin, I would like to thank Minister Silvan Shalom. Minister Shalom, this event is beyond politics. It is your passion and your personal story. When you were the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and I had the pleasure of serving under you as the Director General, you worked tirelessly to forge ties with the Arab states, sending me around the world to places that only you and I knew about. It is a professional privilege and also a personal honor to host you and your First Lady, Judy, at the United Nations and this family of nations. I also want to acknowledge the people that made this day possible today. Ronald Lauder, who works tirelessly all over the world to bring the story of the Jewish refugees to light. Bob Sugarman, you are the President of Presidents, a man who is doing an amazing work. And finally, Stanley Uhrman, whose dedication is inspiring. I'd also like to conclude to thanking Lucette Langnado, Linda Minuchin, Levana Zamir, and Tufik Kassab, who have joined us today to share their personal stories. Ladies and gentlemen, George Orwell famously said, "In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." We're here today to help bring the truth to light and recognize the Jewish refugees who were expelled and forced to flee from Arab states 65 years ago. This is a chapter in the chronicles of history that seems to have fallen off the shelf. They are the UN forgotten refugees. For thousands of years, million Jews live peacefully in Arab states across the Middle East. The Arab world once showcased our historical landmarks and shared our historical moments. Jewish businesses, synagogues, and homes teemed with life, and great Jewish institutions dotted the landscapes of the Middle East. Today, they are no more. Generation after generation of these communities enriched the Arab world with art, culture, and commerce. Little by little, one by one, these ancient communities disappeared. And the question is, what happened? Ladies and gentlemen, to understand what happened, we have to turn back the clock 66 years ago. In 1947, the General Assembly adopted Resolution 181, which provided for the establishment of a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews welcomed the plan and joyously declared a new state in their ancient homeland. But the jubilation of the Jews was matched by the animosity of the Arabs. The Arab nations rejected this decision and vowed to destroy the new Jewish state and punish the Jewish communities. Just 2 years, 2 years only, after the Nazis murdered 6 million Jews in Europe, Arab leaders stood in these very halls of the United Nations, and threatened to massacre their own Jewish communities. In 1947, an Arab delegate to the United Nations told the General Assembly, and I quote, "The lives of 1 million Jews in Muslim countries will be jeopardized by partition." End of quote. In the coming years, Jews living in Arab lands would become targets of their own governments. In Iraq, Zionism was made a capital crime. In Libya, Jewish businesses were burned to the ground. In Syria, anti-Jewish riots erupted and the government froze all Jewish bank accounts. In Egypt, bombs were detonated in the Jewish quarter. Thousands of Jews across the Arab world, from Algeria to Yemen, were murdered in violent riots instigated by Arab governments. The Arab League instructed its members to declare Jews enemies of the state. Laws were passed that prohibited Jewish public worship, and Jews were forced to carry Jewish identity cards. Jewish communities that had existed in the Middle East for more than 2,500 years were expelled or forced to run for their lives. Communities that enriched cultures were robbed of their riches. Communities that were valued by their hosts were deprived of their valuables. And communities once considered an asset to their society were stripped of their assets. Penniless and destitute, they left with nothing more than the shirts on their back. Ladies and gentlemen, the vast majority of these refugees fled to Israel. In its earliest years, Israel was barely able to provide its own. It was surrounded by enemies, threatening it with annihilation, and struggled to stimulate a faltering economy, but did not hesitate for a second to absorb the Jewish refugees. Only a tiny budget strained to feed the refugees, to house them, and to integrate them into society. But we did it. And these immigrants went on to become some of our greatest statesmen, our most brilliant minds in arts, science, and commerce, and our leading doctors, lawyers, and accountants. Especially the Iraqis were accountants. They rose to the highest levels of society and in the process lifted the state of Israel to new heights. Contrast to this treatment by Arab countries of their own people was the strategy which was called NIMBY, not in my backyard. They refused to accept the Arab refugees into their societies and confined them to refugee camps. The Arab states passed discriminatory laws that marginalized the Palestinian refugees. In Lebanon, for example, they are still barred from working as doctors, dentists, lawyers, and engineers or accountants. By making the Palestinians the poster children for international victimhood, the Arab states believe that they hold a permanent trump card to defame and pressure Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, It has been 65 years and the Arab countries have never been held accountable for the crimes that they have committed. In 6.5 decades, they have never taken responsibility for creating the Jewish refugees. And what about the United Nations, the place that we are here in today? Since 1947, there have been 687 resolutions relating to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, 101 of which deals specifically with the Palestinian refugees. And yet, as we speak today, there's not one resolution that says a single word about the Jewish refugees. On 2 separate occasions, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees determined that Jews fleeing from Arab countries met the definition of refugees. Yet it is the Palestinian refugees that have their own UN agency, their own information program, their own department within the UN. None of these exist for the Jewish refugees. Forgetting the victims of an injustice is akin to committing the injustice all over again. We cannot and will not allow the history of the Jewish refugees to be swept under the Persian rug. This is the reason that I've made it my mission to tell the story of the Jewish refugees from Arab countries on the global stage here at the United Nations. And we will keep on telling the story year after year until this organization takes responsibility and rights a great historical wrong. I asked you last year, and I'm asking you again today, open the doors of this institution to the forgotten Jewish refugees. Open your hearts to their suffering, and open your ears to listen to their firsthand accounts. Do not allow the Jewish refugees from Arab countries to be the forgotten refugees. They deserve the truth, they deserve recognition, and they deserve justice. Thank you.
We will now hear from the Honorable Ronald S. Lauder. Mr. Lauder has served as president of the World Jewish Congress since 2007, and before that, he served as chairman of the Conference of Presidents, president of JNF, and many other organizations. Ambassador Lauder is many things. He's an international businessman, a renowned philanthropist, an art collector, a former ambassador, former high-ranking official as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Defense for Europe and NATO Affairs. But above all, he is a deeply committed Jew who has demonstrated throughout the world his commitment in both word and deed, a courageous visionary leader and a devoted champion of human rights for our community and for all and for justice around the world. It is a pleasure and an honor to present to you Ambassador Ronald Lauder.
First of all, Ron Prosor gave my speech. Mrs. Shalom, Ambassador Prosor, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you all for coming here today. Whenever the issue of the Middle East conflict is raised, people refer to the Palestinian refugees. They almost never refer to Jewish refugees from Arab countries. The world has long recognized the Palestinian refugees, but it hasn't recognized the other side of the story. The Jewish refugees from Arab countries. Yet, for any peace process to be credible, it must ensure that all refugees receive equal rights. The Jewish refugees from Arab countries were even more numerous than the Arab refugees from Israel, and their loss of property was, in fact, far greater. Jews lived in the Arab world for 2,500 years, but the rise of Arab nationalism and the conflict in Israel changed that. The new Arab regime orchestrated a campaign of massive violations of the human and civil rights of their Jewish citizens. These states appropriated the property of the Jewish population and stripped them of their citizenship. Jews were murdered, arrested, tortured, or expelled. The persecution of the Middle Eastern Jews started even before the establishment of the Jewish state. The World Jewish Congress has called on Secretary Ban Ki-moon and all world leaders to acknowledge the truth and recognize the Jewish refugees of Arab countries, the legal rights of Jews displaced from Arab countries, and no less legitimate than those of the other Middle East refugees. As Professor Alan Dershowitz explained last year, the rights of Jewish refugees in Arab countries are in fact enshrined in Security Council Resolution 242, which refers to, and I quote, the rights of refugees in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Resolution 242 does not say Arab refugees. It simply says refugees, which means all refugees. Few international leaders have had the courage to speak out on behalf of the rights of Jews from Arab countries. We applaud the Canadian Parliament recommendation that Canada officially recognize and encourage the need for justice for Jewish refugees from Arab countries. As part of any just and comprehensive resolution of the Middle East conflict, we hope that all countries follow Canada's lead. In April 2009, the U.S. Congress adopted a historic resolution that granted recognition of Jewish refugees from Arab countries. It declared that no comprehensive Middle East peace can be reached without recognition of the legitimate rights of Jewish refugees from Arab countries. We hope and expect that this principle will lead to diplomacy as it facilitates Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. This issue is about recognition and historic justice. It's about legality and equality. What are we asking for? Ever since 1948, when the UN tried to solve the territorial dispute between Jews and Arabs by offering a two-state solution, unfortunately, only one side accepted it. That was the Jews. Palestinians were urged by the Arab nations to leave their homes with the idea that Israel would be destroyed. It wasn't. Since 1948, almost 700,000 Palestinians have lived in refugee camps paid for by the UN. Since 1948, we have read about Palestinian refugees almost every day, but we never hear about the Jewish refugees who were forced to leave their homes in Arab lands. We never hear about the refugees who lost their homes, their businesses, their savings. We never hear about them because Israel took them in, Israel made them full citizens, and most important, they understood that the only practical thing they could do was to make a new life in a new land. They lost everything, yet they picked themselves up and created new lives. Why are these people ignored? Why is their claim any less compelling? Why should they also not be recognized? I will suggest an answer here. Palestinians should leave the victimhood they were forced on them by their Arab brothers. They should try to stop trying to go back to 1948, because in the end, and the worst part of this, is the wasted lives. The book's not written, the business is not started, the utterly wasted lives that have been fed a mixture of hatred and violence. We have seen what can be accomplished when people make new lives. It is time for the UN to recognize that both sides have had their share of problems. It's time to acknowledge that there are two groups of refugees in this conflict. While we recognize that the Palestinians have had their own share of problems, we hope that they will be able to rebuild their lives just as the Jewish refugees have done over the past 70 years. I thank you all for coming. Thank you.
The next speaker is someone who needs no introduction and for whom there are no words, me. So, since, thank you for coming. I rise here on behalf of Robert Sugarman, the chairman of the conference, many members of the conference who are here, and also I want to acknowledge the role of Stan Ehrman, who could not be here for family reasons, but as leader of JJAC played a critical role. Our special guest, Minister Shalom, has to leave because he has a family demand and he has to fly back to Israel for a simcha, so we thank him again for being with us. And we thank, as I mentioned, Ron Prosor, all the other sponsors, all the people who helped make this possible, and all of you for coming. Since we gathered last year, we have seen progress, albeit hardly enough, but nonetheless significant. The measures adopted by Israel's Knesset, actions by the U.S. Congress, the government of Canada, and many others attest to this. These are long overdue acknowledgments of an historic outrage and injustice. We still learn new details of its vast scope and sinister reality, of still unaccounted for victims, of international plots and intricate conspiracies to drive the Jews from the houses, cities, and countries. We cannot, must not, and will not compound the tragedy of what occurred by forgetting, ignoring, or failing to fight on every front to reclaim every measure of justice possible for the victims and their descendants. The sacred pledge never again applies to these efforts to remember, reclaim, and restore the historic truths about these once vibrant communities, their histories, their contributions, their customs, their legacy. Never again mandates that we, all of us, all people of goodwill, of faith, of decency, of integrity, will not compound the mass violation of basic rights, property, civil, and even life by pledging to continue to educate, raise awareness, solicit support from our governments and others represented in the United Nations, and to repudiate those who assert that Israel and Jews are not indigenous to the Middle East, are interlopers with no roots, a foreign presence. Erasing the history and the story of the Jews in Arab lands is essential to this distortion of history and denial of Israel's legitimacy. You will hear later in the program from living witnesses who will testify on the mass violation of human rights, about the persecutions, the violence against Jews, the arbitrary arrests and detentions, expulsions, and expropriations of massive individual and Jewish communal assets. These actions replicated in numerous Arab countries did not happen spontaneously or in a vacuum. Documents uncovered by Justice for Jews from Arab Countries in the archives of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva reveal collusion by Arab League states to use their Jewish citizens as leverage in their struggle against the nascent state of Israel. On February 17, 1948, the Political Committee of the Arab League, which included Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Jordan, and Yemen, adopted a 7-point draft law on the treatment of Jews in Arab countries. The draft law had 7 provisions, including requiring Jews to register as members of the Jewish minority state of Palestine, that they are citizens of an enemy state, Israel, freezing Jewish bank accounts and using the funds to finance the war of Arab states against Israel. Jews were arrested and imprisoned for being active Zionists. They had to prove that their activities were anti-Zionist and had to declare their readiness to join Arab armies at war with the state of Israel. These and other measures, with the hostile and threatening environment they engendered, made life for Jews in Arab countries simply untenable and intolerable. Throughout the plight, their plight, the world ignored the displacement, fractured identities, and material losses suffered by these Jewish refugees. And today, as a further injustice, many Arab countries, joined by others, seek to deny Jewish history and pillage the long and proud patrimony of almost 1 million Jews and their countless ancestors. There are 2,800 years of recorded Jewish history in the Middle East and North Africa, a legacy 8 times older than that of American Jewry, which celebrated its 359th anniversary this year. Outstanding figures of Sephardi Jewry have had a profound influence on Jewish learning and thought, By way of example, Judah Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Ibn Ezra, the Rambam, Moshe Nachmanides, Shmuel HaNagid, and Isaac Abarbanel. The list is almost endless. Their writings and scholarships continue to inform, educate, and guide us until today. Sephardic rabbinic authorities created Jewish scholarship, including, among others, the 20-volume Talmud Bavli, which is studied today around the world, and the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, which guides us. Up to 1 million Jews in some 10 Arab countries created flourishing communities with synagogues, schools, hospitals, social centers, cemeteries, and communal associations. These exist no more. Their communal institutions were raided, closed, seized, Torah scrolls and holy books looted, precious artifacts and records scattered, seized, or destroyed. We must reclaim, we must regain control of these vital aspects of our communal heritage and patrimony. Our message must be clear and unequivocal. The artifacts of the Jewish community belong to their rightful Jewish owners, their heirs, or their collective representative communal bodies, and must be returned to them. Jewish tombs and holy sites in Arab countries must be protected, and Jews must be allowed to freely visit in keeping with Jewish tradition and practice. By way of example, great figures from the Bible in later periods, from the tomb of Ezekiel and Jonah in Iraq to the tomb of Yaakov Abuchatzera in Egypt and the tomb of Rabbi Chai Taib Lomet and the pilgrimage site, the Griba Synagogue in Tunisia. We note with remarkable gratitude and appreciation the initiative supported by His Majesty King Mohammed VI of Morocco and led by Ambassador Serge Berjugo, the Secretary General of the Moroccan Jewish Community, to restore and rehabilitate every Jewish cemetery across Morocco. This is the model for every Arab country. We hope and pray that other governments will be inspired to similar actions, which show respect, not only respect for the dead, respect for the living, but even more enshrines and perpetuates Jewish history and their national histories as well. One immediate aspect of this relates to the Iraqi Jewish archives. We are grateful to the United States government, to NARA, the National Archives, and all those involved in rescuing these sacred texts from total destruction in the basement of the Iraqi intelligence, the dreaded Mukhabarat building. They are now on display in Washington, D.C., after being restored with great effort and care. These items were seized from the Iraqi Jewish community, their institutions, and individuals. We urge our government not to send them back to an uncertain fate in Iraq, where hundreds of holy Torah scrolls remain in disuse and decay. They cannot go back. Let them be available to those who rightfully claim it as their patrimony, a link to their past, an inspiration for their future. There are ample precedents of countries that provided scrolls and sacred Judaica to expatriate communities. Let them tour around the globe, and then their future placement can be determined. We have made this We have written to Secretary of State John Kerry and to this administration in an appeal co-signed by more than 40 organizations, including the World Jewish Congress, that the sanctities of these artifacts must be protected in the future and the rights of their legitimate owners to have access to them as well. The hearings in the Canadian Parliament should be replicated, and the support shown by Prime Minister Harper and Foreign Minister Baird should encourage others to do the same. Recognition of the truth can only help foster a better climate for peace. Negotiations that are based on revisionist historical claims will not yield a lasting peace. As former Minister of Justice in Canada, Erwin Kotler, said, in the absence of truth and justice, there can be no reconciliation. It is imperative that we not delay or allow further denial of the essential truth of the Jews from Arab lands. Thank you, Malcolm Homeline. Now, it's my pleasure now to introduce a very distinguished Jewish leader, Silvan Abitbol, who currently serves as the co-president of Justice for Jews from Arab Countries and is the first vice president of the Sephardic community in Montreal. Previously, he served as co-president of the Canadian Jewish Congress. He himself was born in Morocco, and we are pleased to welcome and privileged to have with us Silvan Abitbol.
The Honorable Sylvain Shalom, Ambassador Ron Prosor, worthy ambassadors, distinguished UN officials, honored rabbis, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to appear before you today as co-president of Justice for Jews from Arab Countries. We are an international coalition representing the interests of Sephardi, Mizrahi Jewish from Arab countries. Our mandate is to ensure that justice of Jews displaced from Arab countries assumes its rightful place on the international agenda, and that their rights be secured as a matter of law and equity. At the onset, let me say how proud I am to join with Rabbi Abadi in serving as co-president of Justice for Jews from Arab Countries. Rabbi Abadi provides insight, passion, and reason to our work. He is a man for all seasons who brings JJAC distinction, kavod, and as is in Arabic, hiba. I also appear before you today as a Jew from an Arab country born in Morocco. I was one of the lucky ones. Growing up in a relatively tolerant Muslim society, yet even in Morocco, for all its tolerance, Jews felt compelled to leave. From an estimated 265,000 Jews in 1948, less than 3,000 remain in Morocco. Others were not so lucky. As we all know, during the 20th century, large Jewish populations were persecuted and ultimately displaced from Iraq, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and Algeria. As I stand here today, I can't help thinking of all those vibrant Jewish communities who, within a few years, have been displaced, resettling in Israel and many, many other countries. As I look back, I see the same pattern. Anywhere Jews from Arab countries, in the countries where they found safe haven, we worked hard. We gave an education to our children. We built businesses and communities. We had doctors, lawyers, PhDs. We worked very hard. But what? We gave back way more to the countries where then we were given. In my own country, Canada, I have been told by many, many public servants that we are a model of immigration. However, this success story does not negate the injustice and persecution the Jews from our countries were forced to endure. When Justice for Jews from our countries began its work 12 years ago, there was not a single government that were interested in pursuing rights for justice for Jews from Arab countries. Undaunted, JJAC sought to raise the issue of Jewish refugees in the international political arena. I appeared before the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. My colleagues testified before the European Parliament in Brussels. JJAC has been part of formal government hearings that were held in the US Congress, in the House of Lords in London, in the Chambers of Deputies in Rome, and in the Parliament in Canada. Now that none of what JJAC has accomplished could have been done without our executive director, Dr. Stanley Erman. Stanley's devotion, ethics, and hard work over many years has been essential to any success we've achieved. Today, I appear before you as a proud Canadian. I would like to commend, as has been said before, the Canadian government and its leadership, Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Foreign Minister John Baird. I salute them for their leadership in scheduling hearings of the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Development, where I testified and presented our story. This committee has now recommended that Canada, for the first time, formally recognize the plight of Jewish refugees and recommends that our rights be included in any Middle East peace negotiation. Similarly, a binding landmark will soon be introduced in the US House of Representatives by Congressman Jerry Nadler and five bipartisan co-sponsors. It will reaffirm that in any Middle East negotiations, US officials must ensure that any explicit reference to Palestinian refugees is matched by a similar explicit reference to Jewish refugees. In the quest for peace in the Middle East, what is needed are courageous, moral governments like the United States and Canada, who exert leadership and seek durable solutions who are not cowered into silence by international political expediencies. In closing, I would like to ask a question. Why now? Why now? Why now must Jewish refugees from Arab countries be included in Middle East peace negotiation? The answer is fundamental. Many detractors claim that Israel is an illegitimate state, that Jews are foreigners and do not belong to the region. That is gross and obscene distortion of history. We must underscore in every opportunity that for 2,500 years, Jews have in substantial numbers resided in Middle East and North Africa. We, Mizrahi Sephardi Jews, are the indigenous people of the Middle East. We must not allow the rich and vibrant heritage and patrimony of the Jews in the region to be expunged from the history books. For peace in the Middle East to be durable and enduring, it must ensure that the right of Jewish refugees be recognized and secured as a matter of law and equity. That is our mandate. That is our mission. That is our time. Thank you.
And now we will see a film clip of the Forgotten Refugees, about which we will have immediately thereafter a panel discussion that will be led and introduced by Robert Singer, the recently appointed Secretary General, Director General of the World Jewish Congress. He served earlier as Director General of World Ort, and an old friend from his days as a key diplomat working on behalf of Soviet Jews and representing Israel here in New York and in other places. We are honored and privileged that he could join us. Presented by Jews indigenous to the Middle East and North Africa, The Forgotten Refugees is a documentary about the history and destruction of Middle Eastern and North African Jewish communities with testimony of Jewish refugees from Egypt, Yemen, Libya, Iraq, and Iran. It won an award for Best Featured Documentary at the Warsaw Jewish Film Festival in 2006 and Best Documentary at the Marbella Film Festival in 2007. Please turn your attention to the screens.
I didn't want to think about all what happened, so I just buried my past.
There were 38,000 Jews living in the northern part of Libya at the time. Today, there are none left. Maftel had. The community is totally extinct.
If somebody wants to understand what is going on in the Middle East, they have to understand the Jewish refugees from Arab countries.
I was in Los Angeles on a business trip. I was in a hotel. There was a young lady in her mid-20s. And I could tell from her name and from her looks that she was Egyptian. So I said, Ahlan wa sahlan. He said, oh, do you speak Arabic? I said, yes. And she said, why did you leave Egypt? I said, well, I'm Jewish. He said, oh, I didn't know that there were Jews living in Egypt. And I told her the whole story, and she was shocked.
Thank you. everybody already thinks of Jews as white Europeans. Not all Jews are European. When I sing traditional Middle Eastern and North African Jewish music, people will often say to me, it sounds Arabic. And I say to them, you know, we're not called cousins for no reason. What is Middle Eastern North African has come to be known as Arab. And people forget that there are many other indigenous peoples from the region, and the Jews are one of them.
The Jews were about 2,600 years in Iraq. And when they came to Iraq, they came before the Arabs, before the Muslims, of course.
My family is among the Jews who stayed on that land for the next 2,600 years until they were kicked out around 1950 by the Iraqi government. Jews who stayed in the region are known as Mizrahim, which in Hebrew means Easterners. They either stayed on that land of Babylon, as my family did, or they migrated to lands throughout the region, whether it was Iran, whether it was Syria, Lebanon, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and so on, the entire region. Adami, or Adama, depending on the pronunciation, is a tolerated people. It's the people of the book, Christians and Jews, people who worship, practice the Bible. And according to Islam, this is a group that's supposed to be protected. What that means is, as Islam conquered the entire Middle East, North African region, and killed people in the name of Islam if they would not convert, the Jews and Christians would be spared their lives. However, they always had to be both physically and metaphorically inferior. For example, a Jew could not ride a horse because then his head would be higher than that of a Muslim. Jews could not build a synagogue higher than a mosque.
When I used to walk in the street, little children used to run after me and throw stones at me and calling me, you are a Jew, you are a traitor, and they threw stones at me. Only little kids.
One day we were playing in the field and he turned around and told me, one day we will slit the throat of all the Jews. I was shocked. He was one of my best friends, and I couldn't understand it.
I remember very well Baghdad. Remember the river? My family used to live northern Baghdad. It was a very nice neighborhood, and we had very good relations with the neighbors. The Jews of Iraq, they served the state of Iraq very much, more than any other minority in Iraq. The first finance minister was a Jew.
Leila Murad, she was the diva, the Barbara Streisand, if you will, of the Middle East, and she was an Egyptian Jewish woman who was a beautiful singer, and to this day people are still listening to her music and absolutely love her. Most Arabs do not know that she's Jewish.
I listen a lot to Iraqi music. I read in Arabic. You know, we cook the same food that we used to cook in Iraq. So I'm very much Iraqi as well.
In 1941, there was one nationalist leader, Kailani, who organized a big uprising against the British. The British occupied and so on and so forth. And they always, they take the same opportunity to massacre the Jews. And in Farhud, they also massacred the Jews. The British interfered, and after they massacred what they massacred, the things ended. But it has to be always pointed out, that anti-British sentiment went with anti-Semitic sentiment.
Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Palestinian Mufti, was meeting with the Fuhrer himself, with Hitler, and proposed a final solution to the Jews throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And the Hitler, of course, was delighted. In Iraq, in the 1930s, you had the pro-Nazi government, which led to the Farhud in 1941, in which Jews were completely massacred. What happened was that the mobs went rioting through the Jewish ghetto. They would pull babies apart from their limbs till they broke. They would rape women and daughters in front of the families.
They pulled the Jew among all passengers in the bus. Who is the Jew? And they did the Jew out. They killed them outside the bus.
Hud kilab al Arab. The Jews are the dogs of the Arabs. Or idbah al Yahud. Slit the throat of the Jews. Slaughter the Jews. These were not only on posters, but the people were chanting them. And this was scary to see a crowd coming towards you chanting, "Idbah al-Yahud, kill the Jews."
Rasti wa ibratsima hara, rasti wa ratsima hara, yash nafsuti. Arbitu qad kam mashin maslahi. Zeh sima tere, ratsu lahtof ta yadayim, mit ragdayim, mit rosh, kmo mappa, ayim garzenim. عاشني مسلم وحشبوش أني ميت.
The persecution of the governments of Arab countries made the Jews in Arab countries desire to leave their origin country. But they didn't how, because no country was ready to receive them. So when the State of Israel was established, suddenly we have a shelter, and the Jews came to Israel.
When I came to this desert, there were there nearly 4,000 people in the desert, in that camp, that terrible camp. There was only sand and very little huts that they live in. They never complained. Why? Because they waited. They helped. They knew that tomorrow we shall be saved. Tomorrow we shall go to Israel. On Shabbat, we read that part of the Torah. We read that word, Va'esa etchem al kanfe nisharim va'vi etchem, and I shall take you, you know, with the eagle wings, with the eagle wings, to Israel. And the Sunday, the eagle, or if you want, the aeroplane, came and took the first wave.
Wooden huts, more than 10 years, those Jews were in tents as refugees.
If I say, who are the Middle East refugees, people don't think at all about the Jews. All the people think about are the Palestinians.
Many people ask me, why do you call yourself forgotten refugees? It is interesting to note that in the history of the Middle East, we have been totally cut out of the picture
The United Nations General Assembly since 1947 has adopted 687 resolutions on the Arab-Israeli conflict. 101 of those resolutions dealt with refugees. But all those 101 resolutions dealt with Palestinian refugees only. It's astonishing to realize that not one resolution, not one of these resolutions ever dealt with the issue of Jewish refugees from Arab lands.
We were really the forgotten refugees, and nobody talked about us. And, you know, we were really humiliated, and we didn't get much attention also. We felt like a great injustice has been done to us.
We want our children to remember us, so that we can perpetuate the memory of all these 1 million Jews who were kicked out of the Arab world, and who will never return.
I think the only path to peace is when people can open their hearts and listen to the stories of everyone involved. And this means both the positive things, the points of connection between Arabs and Jews, where there's an overlap of culture, and also the points of oppression.
The Arab governments have taken away our homes. They've taken away our culture. They have destroyed our communities, but they can never take away our spirit to fight for justice.
Each human wants to live. All human wants to live. He wants his family, his children, to continue living. And if we continue this way of killing each other, of these troubles, and so on and so forth, I mean, there is no hope for them, there is no hope for us.
What's important to me is that the stories of everybody be told, and that everybody's history be recognized and everybody's rights be honored.
My name is Robert Singer. I'm the Executive Vice President and the CEO of the World Jewish Congress, which is the umbrella organization of all Jewish communities worldwide, including the communities in the countries that we are dealing with today. I would like to invite the four panelists to tell us their personal stories about what they themselves experienced as young children in the countries they came from. So I'll introduce them one by one before they're speaking. Lucien Laniado, Linda Menuchin, Levana Zamir, Vetofik Kassa, please join us, and the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Ron Prosor, please join us as well at the stage. Lucette Laniado is a well-known author. She was born in Cairo and left Egypt as a refugee with her family when she was a small child. Her recent memoir, The Man in the White Shark Suit, or My Family's Exodus from Old Cairo to the New World, was awarded in the 2008 Sammy Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature. Please, if you can share with us your story.
Which button?
Oh. Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. Thank you. I'm both grateful and honored to be here this afternoon to speak about my Egyptian Jewish family and our exodus from Cairo in the 1960s. I know that you've already heard and will be hearing even more about the ordeal experienced by so many Arab Jews, the persecutions, and the expulsions and the pogroms and the violence. And it's indeed a very sad and little-known chapter of the recent history of the Middle East. The truth is that the Jews of the Arab lands have been the quote-unquote phantoms of history, according to the great Muslim scholar Fuad Ajami. Our story's consistently denied or ignored by pretty much everybody, from the Arab countries where we once lived, even to our own fellow Jews in America, and to the West generally. I'm sorry. As Mr. Ajami once told me, the Arab Jews have been edited out of the narrative of the Middle East. But that's begun to change, I think. It's changing this afternoon a little bit with this gathering. And I know that it started to change for me personally some years ago when I decided to embark on a memoir of my Egyptian Jewish father and his fall from grace between Cairo and Paris and New York. I saw the book as an attempt to chronicle a personal story that had haunted me, the tragic decline of my dad, of members of my family after we left Egypt. I'm sorry, do you need to sit down? I'm not really sure what to do. Excuse me.
No, it's not okay.
We'll resume in a minute. Anyway, so after the book was published, nobody would be more surprised than me by the reaction it received from around the world, as thousands of expatriates, not only Jews from Egypt, but from throughout the Middle East, reached out to tell me that my father's story was also their story. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. The story of my dad, as I told in my book, really began 20 years ago this winter, on the week that my father died in Manhattan. And I found myself going to pray in this very crowded little synagogue on the Upper East Side, which reminded me of him because it was made up of the very people that we're talking about this afternoon. There were exiled Jews from pretty much all the Arab countries, Moroccans, Tunisians, Yemenites, Syrians, Egyptians. And at one point, almost like in a movie, an old woman came over to me to say that she too was from Cairo and that she had known my father as a young girl. Her mother would hold a nightly poker game and she could count on my dad to come. And she remembered watching him approach from her balcony, this very tall, striking man who always wore white shark skin. Other men in Egypt, she said, wore white sharkskin jackets, but only my father wore an entire suit of white. As she and I became friends, I initially asked her only questions about my father, but eventually my questions expanded to this world she had known where men, where Jews wore white sharkskin, Cairo before and after World War II, when it was this glittering world-class city where there were Jews and Muslims and Christians that lived side by side with an extraordinary, almost breathtaking degree of harmony. It was at that time that, as you saw in the film clip, the Jews of Egypt numbered 80,000, a flourishing community that was involved in every aspect of the country's culture and economy. Diversity, multiculturalism, tolerance, all of these buzzwords we Americans love, well, they were actually true, and they were there in abundance in my dad's Egypt once upon a time. The different groups and religions went to school together, and they worked in offices together, and they socialized together, and come the end of the week, they went to pray at their various houses of worship, the synagogues and the mosques and the churches that were everywhere. My dad's Cairo was a place once upon a time where you could sit at a cafe and hear five languages spoken in the same breath, sometimes in the same sentence. And my father was in his element in this city, in this country that was always hopping day and night, that would come alive at night, where you could get a fine meal at 1 and 2 in the morning, and there in the midst of all, I picture him resplendent in his white sharkskin suit, a bon vivant, a boulevardier, who didn't so much walk the streets of Cairo as own them. And so that's a happy story I'm telling you, isn't it? Very hopeful. But unfortunately, it doesn't end there. Unfortunately, as I tell everyone I know, this is a story without a happy ending. The story that I have tried to tell, that I'm still trying to tell, is about a lost world, a world that vanished and was never even mourned. The Jewish community of Egypt, for sure, but of every other country in the Middle East where it has vanished. And also the story, though, of one man, my dad, who could never stop mourning it. His world and mine and ours began to change years before that day in 63 when we had to abandon all we had. There were several key markers, of course, 1948, the overthrow of King Farouk in 52, the fires that year that destroyed so many Jewish businesses, the rise of the Nasser regime, a regime that decided that Egypt was only for Egyptians, and that those foreigners in their midst included Jews who, like my father, had been there for decades. A population that had lived in Egypt for generations found itself unwanted, and the 80,000 Jews left in waves, 48, 52, 56, 57, 67. Those are the dates we all repeat to ourselves, iconic dates that mark more and more departures. And this little community of mine, or maybe not so little, that was once so close that families lived within blocks of each other, began to split apart as people fled to any countries that would take them, literally to the ends of the earth. One day, the rumor was that the Australian embassy was giving out papers, visas, and lines of Egyptian Jews formed around the block. The next day, it was Brazil, and people began to leave for Sao Paulo, for New Zealand, for Johannesburg, for London, Paris, Rome, Madrid, New York, anywhere that would take them. And of course, Israel, which was the only place that would take them, no questions asked. After 56, it was my grandmother who had to go, my lovely aristocratic grandmother, Alexandra of Alexandria, born into wealth, raised by French governess, taught nothing in the way of taking care of herself, and so helpless that it was said she didn't even know how to comb her own hair. In her old age, she had become very poor, and she survived on the largesse of the Jewish community of Cairo, a very generous community that gave to its own. But these generous donors were leaving also. The institutions, the communal institutions that supported Alexandra, were shutting down one by one. There was no one left who could help her. And so it was decided she too had to leave. And we promised, my parents and my family, that we would join her. And this is how I described my grandmother's departure, which haunted us so much and haunts us still. My family went to see Alexandra as she prepared to depart. The dock was impossibly crowded, as if all the remaining Jews of Egypt had chosen that moment to go. The thin old woman with a white hair tied back in a bun was allowed on board without a fuss. Nobody offered to help her or carry her luggage. Chivalry, once an essential ingredient of life in Egypt, had also disappeared, as if it too were a relic of the colonialism that had to be eradicated. Alexandra of Alexandria was gone, an old woman, nearly blind, trying to hold on to her heavy valise on a crowded boat. And then, in 1963, it was our turn. My father had resisted as long as he could. He was an Egyptian. This was his city, his country. But it was clear, it was completely clear that we couldn't stay. We were one of the few remaining ones. And so we too found ourselves in that same harbor in Alexandria with our 26 suitcases containing all our earthly belongings and about $200, which was all we were allowed to take out to support a family of six, which I can assure you wasn't a lot of money even in 1963. And this is what happened on the boat leaving Egypt. My father began to scream. "Rada'una Masr," he said. "Take us back to Cairo." He had lost all inhibitions, and for a man whose life had exemplified elegance and propriety, all sense of decorum seemed gone. He would cry out when he sat alone, and he would cry out in front of other passengers when we were with him and when we weren't, inside the privacy of our lower berths and out in the open air. And oddly, no one seemed to mind or even to find it strange. The sight of this irate old man, at times yelling, at times moaning, "Take us back to Cairo." He was only saying what was in our hearts. He was 62 years old. I suppose that he had a premonition that his life was effectively over. We ended up here in New York, and from the beginning, we were exposed to this idea of assimilation, of the American dream, this notion that you come here with nothing as an immigrant or a refugee, but if you only work hard enough and struggle and join in and assimilate and blend, you will do well, perhaps even beyond your wildest dreams. But what of those people like my father who couldn't or wouldn't assimilate? Well, it wasn't so easy for them, wherever they were, New York or Sao Paulo or Rome or Paris. It wasn't so easy, and the dream turned into a nightmare. In my father's case, the social worker assigned to Americanize us kept telling him to embrace the values of the new world. "But we are Arab, madame," he responded to her, according to the case notes. She looked at him. He seemed so old and wondered how he would support a family of six. She urged him to go on welfare. "I have always worked, madame," he said to her. My father never found a job in America, but he did work. This is what the boulevardier of Cairo, the man in the white sharkskin suit, had to do to survive in New York. He became a tie salesman. He would wander the streets and subways of New York with a big beige cardboard box filled with ties. How do I know? Because he often took me with him. And I can assure you, by the way, sitting here today, that I wasn't in the least embarrassed. The ties were so beautiful, I found, and they had labels on them, 100% silk, made in Paris, made in Rome. They were none of that, of course. They were made in a little sweatshop in the Lower East Side. My father never stopped crying, "Rada'una Masr." I had the fortune, I suppose, of going back to Cairo several times in recent years. And I have to say, I received an extraordinary welcome from ordinary Egyptians who became the biggest fans of my books. They reach out to me even today through Facebook. They come to my readings and they say, "You are as Egyptian as we are. Come back." It is almost as if they too realize that they were the victims also, that they were the ones who also suffered a terrible loss. I'd like to end today by telling you, I was very struck by Malcolm Hohenlein's comments about all the cultural artifacts that were lost in the Middle East. As a journalist, I've been assigned to cover the recent scandal on the looted Nazi art taken from the Jews, which has been such a major issue for Ambassador Ron Lauder. And I found myself wondering about the destroyed cultural artifacts of Egypt and all the other Arab countries, the magnificent Torah scrolls and other Judaica items that have never been accounted for, that have never been cared about. And I thought to myself, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we had our own Ambassador Lauder to also begin to track what happened and to begin to reclaim and to begin to request and to begin to demand. I think of that as I close, of an incident that happened to me in Egypt, actually, a couple of years ago, when I asked somebody where I could pray for the Sabbath, and she said, well, you could go to pray at the Adli Street Synagogue, the greatest synagogue in Egypt. And off I went for Shabbat Saturday morning. It was a synagogue that once seated 500 people. And let me tell you, as I sat there, the only person there, alone, that to me was the very definition of sadness and loneliness. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Luciette. Thank you, Luciette, for your very emotional story. I'll pass your message to Ambassador Ronald Lauder, and I'm sure that you'll find him as fighting for the culture that lost in all these lands, the same way he's fighting for the culture, Jewish culture lost in Europe. Our next speaker is Linda Menuchin, who serves as a commentator on Middle East affairs, both in Israeli and Arab media. As an Iraqi refugee, Ms. Menuchin overcame personal tragedy to become a strong activist for peace. She previously served as a spokeswoman at the Ministry of Public Security and as a senior journalist with the Israeli Broadcasting Authority. Please, Linda.
Thank you very much for the introduction.
Okay, this is a new microphone for me. I'm so agitated by Lucette's words that I really don't feel I would like to read what I have prepared. This reminds me, you know, the difficulty when you are uprooted from your country. Actually, what a Palestinian poet, Mahmoud Darwish, has said, and I completely identify with it, and I'm sure all the Jews who were uprooted also feel the same. He said, "My homeland is not a suitcase, and I'm not a passenger." So it's so hard, really, you know, when Lucette was speaking about her father, I could hear my father say that, but he never did. My father was so fond of Iraq, and I don't know if he ever imagined that Iraq will betray him the way it did. My father was abducted in 1972, on the eve of Yom Kippur, when he didn't show up to the synagogue. I already fled from Iraq at the end of 1970. And later on, my sister and my mother also fled the country. And my father was adamant not to make any illegal move. He was adamant to wait for a passport. He was a very well-known lawyer in Iraq, and all he cared for, really, he cared for Iraq and the Iraqis, not only Jews. He used to say, I charge the Jews more because the Jews have money, but these poor Muslims for free. And it hurts. It definitely hurts. When I left Iraq, I thought, at last, I will check out from this country, from this identity. Look at me. After 40 years, I realized that you don't check out from your identity as you check out from a hotel. And it's really very hard. I made my decision at the time in Iraq that I won't stay any longer. That was at the end of 1970, after all the tragic events that we witnessed there. The milestone started actually in 1967, after the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War. Israel's victory found us victims in Iraq because only from the Jews they could take their revenge, unfortunately. We had no one at the time to defend us. So there were many measures taken against the Jews, severe measures, very much inspired by what the Nazis did to the Jews, very much. The only thing, they didn't put us in camps. So first of all, they cut off our phone lines. Then Jews are not allowed to go to the university after they finish high school. And then Jews are not allowed to go far away from home, I think 80 kilometers or less. Jews were not allowed, were not given permission to be hired to work somewhere. So they were really very much closing the circle around the Jews. And everybody could feel the fear. And I remember that I used to fast every Thursday and Monday and pray that nothing will happen to us, because the Iraqis started to interrogate people, to ask people, just to knock on the door, ask someone to be questioned, and then he will go to be questioned, and he never came back. Sometimes they returned, most of the time, I think, they returned the bodies. And my father, I think, was the first case where a Jew was kidnapped and disappeared. Nobody was delivered. And at the end of 1970, I think 1972 or in the 70s, I'm a bit confused right now because I'm so agitated. There were 20 cases whereby Jews disappeared without leaving any trace. And I would like really from this podium to ask the Iraqis, the Iraqi ambassador in the United Nations, the Iraqi ambassador in Washington, to do something about it. This is a humanitarian question. Even in Islam, people are buried. They are entitled to a tomb. We need this for our closure. I lend my voice to this story because I believe that, as have been said here before by many speakers, that telling the truth is very important for reconciliation. Even today, I have no bitterness at all. I really wish the Iraqi people all the best. And it's painful to see all these explosions on a daily basis, and nobody cares. Probably I care more. I went to the exhibition in Washington to see the documents that were seized, the Jewish documents that were seized by the USA and brought over. And I was really hoping that I would see at least, you know, just one document regarding this issue of the Jews and my father. But to no avail. This story, the story that I'm telling you about myself and my father, has been the topic of a documentary film called a shadow in Baghdad. It has been released 2 months ago in Israel, and it has been a hit. It is being screened at least twice a week in Tel Aviv Cinematheque, and the hall is always full. People are calling me, people that I don't know who they are. This brings to them memories. And some of them knew my father. Even someone called that he is 90 years old. He told me that my father was teaching him when he was in third grade. You can't imagine how moved I was. I don't want to take more of your time. I'm really thankful for all this big event, and I think we need to put this subject on the agenda on a daily basis, on a yearly basis, because there are so many events competing on the agenda that, you know, if we are not persistent, we cannot get there. I would like to end with a happy note because I'm an optimistic person after all. I just saw this morning an article that made me smile. And it's a story. An Iraqi journalist wrote a story about how he tried to approach three wealthy Iraqis. One is Sunni, one is Shi'i, and one is Kurd. And he has projects to offer so that they will set up these projects in Iraq for the benefit of the Iraqis. But none of them was ready to put this kind of money, like $2-3 million, to set up these projects to benefit the Iraqi, because the Sunni didn't want the Shi'i to benefit from it, and the Shi'i didn't want the Sunni to profit, and the Kurd obviously didn't want the Arab to profit from this project. And at the end he said, I was surprised to see that a philanthropist, an Iraqi Jew, Naim Dangour from London, has donated £5 million or dollars to the Iraqis without distinguishing between who is this Iraqi. So at the end of the at the end of his words, he said, well, we don't only accept Jews, accept Israelis. We are ready to endorse even the extreme Zionist if they are ready to serve their country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda, for sharing with us your painful story and also for ending it on a positive note. Levana Zamir serves as the president of the International Association of Jews from Egypt. Mrs. Zamir, a family roots in Egypt date back over 2,000 years. She became an Egyptian refugee at the age of 11 when her family fled to France. And now Levana lives in Israel.
Okay. Erev tov, chaverim. Good afternoon, friends. Thank you for coming. Friends from Egypt, living in New York, Arlet, Vivi, Dina Rekanati, Monique, thank you so much for being here with me, with us. Well, my story begins on May 14, 1948, the day David Ben-Gurion declared the establishment of the State of Israel. At midnight, 10 Egyptian officers broke into our house, searching everywhere. They opened all the closets, all the drawers. They cut the mattresses. They found nothing. They did the same to my uncle Habib Vidal. They found nothing too, but they took him to prison. They said, they told him, you are a Zionist. He wasn't. He just wasn't. We had a movement of young Zionist adolescents, but not really the generation of my father, my parents, our family. The same night, Egyptian authorities did the same to 1,600 Jewish men and 50 women. They put them in prison. Next day, the Egyptian authorities confiscated our family business, one of the largest printing houses in Cairo, owned by my father and his two brothers, one of them in prison. So they said, you are Zionists, you are enemies of this country, so we confiscate all your assets, and they did. But my own trauma was next day when I went to school. The teacher told me, they took your uncle to prison. I couldn't believe, because at this age, 10 years old girl, for me, going to prison, you must be a criminal. My uncle was a criminal. I cried and ran, asking my mother. She explained to me calmly, they took him to prison because we are Jews. All of a sudden, for me, being a Jew was a crime. While at school, my best friend all the years, was a Muslim, Eitan Heikal, an aristocratic Muslim family. The second one was a Christian, Yvonne Fadul. We used to be the trio at school. Not anymore for me. I felt marginal. I was a Jew. It was a crime. My parents never shared their problems with us, but I realized that never things will be the same again. Nothing will be again the same. And then persecutions began all over the streets of Cairo. My brother, 16 years old then, on his way to school in the bus, was beaten by a group of young Arabs, Muslims. By chance, a good friend of him, a Muslim, Ghazar, I remember him. He was the best friend of my brother. He saw him bleeding already. So he shouted to this young crowd, leave him alone, he is a Muslim like us. He saved his life. But it wasn't enough. In the middle of the night, the telephone rang. I am sure Lisette knows that. The telephone rang and nobody there. Silence. Some other times, we felt stones on our windows, thrown on our windows, and we didn't even dare to open and look who did it. At the same times, in 1949, the Muslim Brotherhood declared that all the Jews in Egypt has to be now back to the dhimmi status. I'm sure you know what it means. Well, it didn't happen because then the Muslim Brotherhood was a marginal party, not today. And they are doing this to the Christians, the cops they burn, as we just heard here. They burned churches. Then they couldn't do it, but it wasn't nice for us to hear that. When hundreds of us were in prison, our assets confiscated. After 2 years in prison, my uncle was released on one condition. He had to leave Egypt directly from prison, handcuffed to the ship. We had to live with him. Egyptian authorities came to us, to my father, telling him, look, you will find your brother on that ship, that day, that hour. Go on, it faddalu. It was clear. we had to leave. In the middle of the night, like thieves, we left home. My mother just closed the door and we went to Alexandria with one suitcase, each one of us, and 20 Egyptian pounds. But you know, I was very happy. On our way to Alexandria, I discovered that we are going to France. Well, good. I spoke French at school, at home, everywhere. France was a culture. I was really glad. But not for us. For us, France was just a refugees camp, Camp d'Arenas, near Marseille. We just received a hangar for three families, a narrow room, each family a wall. We had 9 beds because we are 7. I have 6 brothers and me and my parents, so we had 9 beds on a wall. That was home for us. It was horrible for my parents, you can imagine, after the life we had in Egypt. As yesterday, one of my friends said, Dina, you told me that it was very easy for everybody, for all the Jews to live well and beautifully and nice in Egypt. Even the poor, they could have very, very nice and beautiful life, and it was so. So for my parents, it was horrible, but also for us. I remember once I wanted to go out of the refugee camp with my 2 young brothers, and French children, our age, shouted on us, "Sale juif." You know what it is? It's dirty Jews. I didn't understand then. I asked my mother, "What's that?" She told me they don't like us. That's all. And then, 3 months after this refugee camp, the Sochnut came to my father and told him, you know, the Jewish agency, they told him, "Now you can make Aliyah, it's your turn, you and your family." But my father said, "Just a minute, no, I don't want to make Aliyah. I began to work in Marseille. We will leave soon the refugees camp, and that's it." But then my mother, it was the first time I heard my mother telling my father no, because in Egypt it was always my father telling what we have to do. She said no, and she succeeded. She said, "I want to go to a country where everybody is a Jew, so nobody could tell my children Sal Juif anymore." And we did. We made Aliyah. But what she didn't know, that the refugee camp in Israel, the Ma'abara, was awful, the most terrible refugee camp. We just got a tent, a big one, of course, we are 9 persons. But in the winter of 1950, it was a very, very hard winter. And in the middle of the night, the rain, the wind, the tent blew up. And all the rain on us. Now I can laugh, but it wasn't a comedy at all. It was very hard. Well, after 3 years in the refugee camp, we went out of the refugee camp. Not like the other group of refugees who are still in camps with their children, their grandchildren, and their grand-grandchildren. By the way, I met with Aitan Heikal, my Muslim friend. She came to Tel Aviv. She came to my house. She even slept in our house in Tel Aviv. I went back to Cairo. It was really like a dream come true. We never talked politics. We just felt just like in our childhood. That's it. People to people. Now, I hope they already put this document you see here. It's a certificat de réfugié. It's a refugee certificate given for Jewish refugees from Egypt when they left or were expelled. And this one was given, you must know that, perhaps you can read, It was given by the mandate of the United Nations for Refugees under the New York, it's written somewhere, under the New York Convention from 1954. So what are we talking about? We want recognition? This is a certificate. And Vivian Acker, then from Alexandria, is now here. She is American citizen. She's Vivian Levy. Vivian, I want you to, okay. So you see, this is the real thing. And not only Egyptian Jews were recognized as refugees, also Iraqi Jews, because they were stripped from their citizenship, so they became stateless. So you are a refugee. You know what? I am a refugee living in Israel, which is a huge refugee camp, believe me, but a prosperous one, where everybody is learning, everybody is working. More than 55% of Israeli citizens are refugees from Arab countries. Do you know that? That's the truth. Minister Silvan Shalom told me once, we are more than 55%. Israel, the state of Israel, is a miracle. It's not for granted. It's not invincible. God will help us to continue to keep this miracle continuing for the people of Israel, for Am Israel. Thank you. Toda Rabba.
Our last speaker, thank you, Levana. Our last speaker is Tofik Kassab. Tofik was the head of the Jewish community of Aleppo, Syria, and left Syria relatively recently. He lived there during different crisis situations, including during the time of the wars between Syria and Israel, and has so much to share with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Tofik Kassab. I was the president of the Jewish community in the city of Aleppo, Syria. First of all, I would like to thank Rabbi Eli Abadi, president of the organization Justice of Jews in Arab Countries, for giving me the privilege to speak about the Jewish people history in Syria. For thousands of years, the Jewish community was living in three cities in Syria: Damascus, the capital, and Aleppo City and Qamish City. In 1940s, the community of the Jewish people was over 26,000 members in Aleppo alone, and they were having a good life. And they owned lots of real estate, business, and bank account. Total values is billions of dollars. In 1947, after Israel was approved by the United Nations to be State of Israel, the Jewish community started to have lots of problems in their daily life. In 1948, the Arab people made the biggest tragedy in our history. They burned down all our houses and businesses and all our synagogues, including our big synagogue that was built 2,500 years ago and burned some of our most magnificent Bibles in our history. Then most of our community had to leave everything they had and they leave the country. We was suffering from the Syrian government treatment. For example, any member from the Jewish family escaped from Syria to border of Turkey or Lebanon, the Syrian FBI has to arrest the father for 10 days in their prison. And these things happened to my father. When my sister escaped to Lebanon in 1968, they took my father to the prison for 10 days. And when they released him back home to, he was very sick. We took him to the hospital. And 1 year later, he passed away. And that happened to all the Jewish families. The Syrian government opened an office under the name of Property Management for the Jewish Refugees. And this office was collecting all the income that comes out from those properties and have them in a bank account till now. In 1982, I received an invitation from community leaders in the United States to come to New York for a meeting with the other leaders from Jewish communities in the world. I did meet many members of congressmen in the US, and they wanted to know about our situation as Jews in Syria. I told them, unfortunately, we are hostages by the Syrian government, and we need your help. And since that time, the United States government started to work with the Syrian government to let our people go out of Syria. And all the thanks to the United States of America. In 1992, the Syrian government gave the freedom to the Jewish people to leave the country. In a few short months, all the Jews were out of Syria. Ladies and gentlemen, nobody can imagine that could happen to the Jewish communities if we're still living there today with all the troubles and the fights that is happening over there. Thank you for all. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
Thank you, Tofik. I think that the four personal stories of four people tell the whole story of our event today. The initiation for this event came from the Israeli embassy at the United Nations. And in my job as the executive vice president of the World Jewish Congress, I'm meeting with dozens ambassadors, foreign ministers, heads of the states on a monthly basis. When I go to sleep and I think that Ron Prosor is the ambassador representing Israel in this house, in the United Nations, I know that the matter or the interests of the State of Israel are in the hands of one of the best diplomats in the history of the Israeli Foreign Service. I would like Ron just to close this event.
Robert, thank you very, very much. Especially, I think I'm speaking on behalf of everyone, saying that we're all humbled to really hear your personal stories that tell an amazing history. And I think it is our responsibility, each and every one of us, to really put these stories in the public domain and to make sure that your story, which is our story, the story of the Jewish people, is told at the highest places and on the world stage. And I make a promise on behalf of the State of Israel that we will pursue this issue until justice is made to the cause and the people who have really suffered so long. Thank you very, very much, and thank you for being here.